welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this afternoon's session. I'm delighted to be able to introduce Bill Shields, who is now a research professor in history at York University, having served as a distinguished member of the university since 1988. He was one of the provosts. He was also head of the history department before he retired. He's an expert on British religious and social history and was president of the Ecclesiastical History Society in 2008-09. He's also the author of many books and articles on early modern religion, one of which I have particular fondness for, which was about preaching in the Diocese of York in the Civil War period, just before the Civil War broke out. And that's one of my favourite articles, and it actually helped me to write some of my own research. Not that I haven't read a lot more of his writings. And those writings include books on the English Reformation from 1513 to 1570, and the Puritans and the Diocese of Peterborough from 1558 to 1610 as well. And this afternoon, Bill is going to be speaking to us about the Reformation, the view from the north. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you very much. Title, of course, is, you know, you're asked to do these things, you think of a title, and then you suddenly realise that actually there are lots of views from the north, in a sense. It's just kind of like Chris Hayes' English Reformations. There is no one view from the north. So what I'm trying to do, I think, today, assuming most of you teach this or have taught it at some stage, so we're not going to get an account of what happened, I want actually to look at ways in which we might identify those factors which are most helpful in trying to explain the process, and of course it is a process rather than an event, which has come to be called the Reformation. And I want to look at that more or less across the north of England, as you find, of course, in geography, textbooks, as the north of Trent. And I probably will be saying a little bit more about this side, well, I will certainly be saying a little bit more about this side of the Pennines than the other side, and that's simply an accident of geography on my part, really. But one can refer to the work of Chris Hay very fully, I think, for the Lancashire material. I want to really, discussing the Reformation, of course, quick, slow, from above, from below, was it long, was it short? It's kind of debate is kind of interminable, really, and certainly lasts longer than the process itself, it seems to me. And it's really in that kind of, with those in the background of that debate, that I want to isolate, I think, six sort of factors which play into the story, and which I think, one of them I think has particular resonance in the northern counties. The others I think you could use across the sort of the country, in terms of explanation and the factors which might be important. First of all, I want to talk about the hold of late medieval piety, examine, if you'd like, the Duffy thesis about the strength and vigour of the late medieval church. I then want to talk about the tenacity of the monastic tradition. Okay? And that's where I think the northern element comes in, I think, here. I then want to talk about how those two factors relate to social and political power as exercised in the northern counties, and maybe they differentiate a bit from certainly some of the southern, southeastern counties, though I think they are reflective of other more, I hate to use the word peripheral, but some border regions, such as the Welsh Marches, and probably the southwest as well. So then after that, looking at those, I then want to look at the institutional structures of the church, actually, as we finally get to see in what ways the actual institutional organisation of the established church in the north of England either hindered or aided the process of Reformation. And in the following on the context of that, I then want to look at ways in which ideas got transmitted throughout this region, how these ideas were transmitted, and then I think that leads, following also from the institutional structures, into the whole question of evangelization and the actually, if you like, which I think in some ways here, certainly those who came up from Oxford and Cambridge and had probably been educated at Winchester or St. Paul's, came up here to work, found a missionary enterprise, as it were. They found an environment which was very unfamiliar from the environments in which they had been educated in the south of England in, say, the 1550s or the 1560s. So they're the elements I want to play with part of this talk. So let's start with late medieval piety, the outlines of which, of course, are really familiar to anyone who teaches the period. We've got, as it were, a ubiquitous presence of the church in late medieval society, from the fraternities and religious guilds who operate at parish level. Any of you who've gone into a parish church of any antiquity in your own localities will know of chapels and altars. You will still see probably a restored light as well, representing a guild light in those churches. Parish guilds are, as it were, everywhere, and members of congregations belong to these. It's sometimes called voluntary religion, and I'm not sure actually if that's an appropriate word for me. I think more associational religion, because I'm not sure how many of these people had choices about whether to belong to a guild or not. In that sense, I think these guilds were part of your kind of rites of passage, your cursus through life. So you joined a guild at various stages of your life, and not joining a guild was not really an option. So I think they are associational religion. I think a more useful term than voluntary religion. They are sort of extra, if you like, to the kind of formal religious structures of the church, but I'm not sure that they're voluntary, certainly not at the parochial level. But guilds and fraternities, of course, cut across that and went beyond, if you like, parishes as well. So in a city like this, at York, you have civic religious fraternities as well, which encapsulate, in many ways, the corporate structure of the city as well. So most of the leading citizens of York would either belong to the Corpus Christi Guild or the Guild of St. Christopher and St. George. And in some ways, belonging to those guilds, those religious associations, establishes and exemplifies your status within the community. So religious guilds there again, I think, are a necessary part of belonging in those communities. And the counties would have them as well. The county, country gentry. Here in York, we have a guild of St. Anthony with its own guild hall at the far end of town. I should have pictures, I'm really sorry about this. And that actually was a guild, a religious guild, which was brought together both the city and the surrounding country gentry. So you have these associations cutting through and beyond the parochial, if you like, the simply parochial structures of the church. They bring you into contact with your peers for religious purposes, beyond the parish, okay? And some of those guilds, of course, produced important, as well as architectural, they produced important cultural products, and particularly in the north, we have a rich survival, and it is a survival of mystery play evidence, the regular pageants and performances of the life cycle. Did any of you come to the mystery plays in York this last year? Am I wrong? Yes, that's right. You know, so you get the annual performance, if you like, of the history of creation, rather than history of religion, history of creation from the making of the world to doomsday, put on through the city by the kind of merchant guilds and the craft guilds, and organised often through the religious guilds. And in Yorkshire, well, in the north, we have Wakefield, Chester, York, Newcastle, and other less fragments of others. So that sort of religious performance, if you like, or socio-religious performance is very much a part of the fabric of late medieval piety. Alongside those, we've got chantry priests in every parish as well, just like religious guilds almost. We know in York, for example, there are 2.5, of course there's no such thing as half a priest, but there are 2.5 priests in every parish in the city. This is a level, if you like, of penetration of the clergy, which of course the Reformation fractures. Right, and changes. So there's a sense in which the relationship between or the presence, if you like, of clergy in those parishes, and most of whom, of course, are embedded in that local community as well, if not in the parish itself in a place like York, in the city or in the neighbouring countryside. These are local men with local family connections. So that although there is clearly a formal structural boundary between clergy and laity, in social terms, in the late medieval church, that's entirely sort of non-existent. These people have neighbours. They have families who are neighbours and friends, and often, of course, enemies as well, like more local community structures. So I think one wants to see the clergy as embedded in their local communities. Outside the parishes, monks and friars, here again, large numbers of monks in the north of England. In St. Mary's Abbey at the Eve of Dissolution, the monastic ruins just across the river there, there are 54 monks in the community on the eve of the dissolution of the monastery. Other great houses in Dales, which some of you would have visited, Fountains, or in North York Moors at Revo, had similar numbers, and then there were many much smaller ones. But monastic life in the north of England and in Lincolnshire is rooted very strongly in the community. And again, if you look at these people, you find that the priors or abbots or prioresses are usually members of the local gentry landowning classes and families. They're embedded in the community. And if you look at the surnames of the monks, they're listed, of course, at the eve of the Reformation, you find, of course, that their surnames often reflect their villages and towns and hamlets around the neighbourhood, as it were, where the monastery is situated. So again, these people are withdrawn from the world. Of course, that's what monastic life's about. But actually, their experience is that they're rooted in those communities. They're often, of course, come from families who are tenants of those monastic houses, farming tenants. So those links are very, very strong. Beyond that, I think you're also, the North Ridge has some very important sites of pilgrimage. Durham Cathedral is, of course, the principal one, with St. Cuthbert, and the banner of St. Cuthbert, and the shrine of St. Cuthbert, kind of providing a focus, if you like, for regional identity in ways which I think in the south of England you don't quite get. So you get great shrines, possibly in Herefordshire, but you don't get that close association of a regional identity with a particular shrine anywhere else like you get, I think, in Durham. And of course, as well as Cuthbert's shrine, they have beads as well. So you've got a huge sort of vigorous, if we like, tradition of it. Essentially a religious one, but which cuts across all kinds of social and political contexts. And I'll say a bit about that later on. And in York, we've got St. William's Shrine, of course, in less important, but nevertheless significant shrine. The remains of a reconstruction of which you can see in the museum, the Yorkshire Museum, if you're spending some time there today. And Richard Scroope, of course, from a local family and Archbishop, never quite made sainthood, though they tried very hard, but his shrine was an important important site of pilgrimage in the Minster. Ripon has St. Wilfrid, Knaresborough up the road has St. Robert. So you've got that sort of pattern, if you like, of pilgrimage, I think, in the area. And there we are. You have, I painted quite deliberately, if you like, that sort of sense of late medieval piety being embedded in the community, drawing on the families from the community, and it's vigorous, I think, and ubiquitous. It's a strong sort of argument in support of the Duffy thesis about, if you like, the ways in which the laity found the provision of the medieval church at the parochial and at the local level as a very satisfying way of understanding their place in the world. I raise a question about whether it was quite like that later on. But I want to talk about the monasteries. I've mentioned them before, and you know, all of you know, of course, that the North region is the site of, I suppose, the largest and most widespread popular revolt against the Tudor state, albeit collapsing. And we know also, or you will know, of the variety of secular and economic causes or catalysts to that particular rising. So it wasn't just about the monasteries. Nevertheless, I think in my view, Jackie's view, she may have a different view. I do think religion provides a kind of focus for those differing political and economic dissatisfactions, which gives this sort of right and the opportunity to transcend, if you like, the entirely local. It is a regional rising from Lincolnshire, from Lancashire, across the East Riding, a bit up in Durham. You've got, and they're all not part of one movement, and the Durham one is probably a bit detached, really, but the others do get a sense, if you like, of sharing a common purpose. And there's no other rising that actually does provide that. And we can see here, they line up behind the banner of the five wounds of Christ, the wounds of the Passion. And that's quite important because the late medieval church, again, certainly in York, if you go to the All Saints Pavement Church at the end of the Parliament Street here, you'll see the Passion window. The five wounds and the Passion of Christ is a very important part of late medieval piety, particularly here in the north. It's formed part of the central part of the mystery plays, and so the five wounds of Christ is a very powerful rallying cry for any sort of insurrection or dissatisfaction. In Durham, of course, they're falling behind the banner of St. Cuthbert. So if you like the emblems of these risings, and I don't think we should ignore emblems, they don't provide all the explanation, but they do provide, as it were, rallying cries and rallying points for those engaged in the rising, whether it be because of bad harvests or because of poor tenant landlord arrangements, whatever. The banners are, I think, the things which keep the thing together. Of course, the rebellion fails, we know that, and there is repression, and the state has to develop an institutional structure to deal with what obviously it identifies as an unsafe part of the country, where it cannot feel confident in governing through a local systems of administration. I'll come on to that later. But first of all, I want to talk about the dissolution of monasteries, the failure of prison of grace, but the tenacity of the monastic tradition. The monks did not go away. They ceased to live together in communities, not always actually, but mostly. They were dispersed, but many of them, of course, carried their priestly vocation into the parishes in the areas in which the monasteries had taken place. So that, for example, a small monastic house with, I think, 12 clergy in the North York Moors at the dissolution, Gromont, at the end of the Pickering railway line, actually, if you're train buff. Gromont Abbey has 12 monks, 9 of whom continue as parish clergy in that region, and 6 of whom are still there in the early 1570s. So you've got a real kind of, and that can be repeated in other sort of areas too, where the monastic life, if you are, the traditions which they've been formed in, survive into the 1570s. All right, so these may not be advocates of continued monasticism, but they're certainly not, in most, almost all cases, either going to be advocating advanced religious change. So you've got a strong tradition of communities still being served by ex-monastic clergy who, as I suggested already, are strongly part of their local communities. Holy Trinity Priory here in York becomes a parish church. It also, the monks there keep in touch. Of course, in a city, it's a bit more easy to do, I guess. We have evidence from their wills. They're lending books to each other, they're keeping the monastic books together, they're leaving them in their wills. They've got a sense amongst that community, the Benedictine community, just up the road, just up the hill here, inside the walls, of a sense of hanging on to that identity. And the last will of a monk of Holy Trinity Priory mentions 3 of their books, and that's 1582. So this, what I'm saying is you've got a very strong continuity going here. The nuns at Swine Abbey in the East Riding moved into the family home, or some, but two-thirds of them moved into the family home of the prioress, the Templars family, and continued a kind of quasi-monastic existence for we don't know how long, all right? But there's an attempt to keep something going in there. But the most famous example, I think, is Durham Priory. Durham Priory, of course, is reformed as a chapter of a cathedral. Not surprisingly, as many of the reformed priories, the last prior becomes the first dean. Now that's not surprising, happened in Peterborough, happened in Gloucester, we know all that. But what is interesting, there are 12 canons in Durham Cathedral, and 10 of them were former monks of the community. And those 10, it's interesting, demography is very important here. They're also a very young, lively community, and they all had BBs. Durham, of course, had a college in Oxford, Durham College, now Trinity College, I think. Yes, Trinity College founded from it, Oxford. 10 of them are still there in 1558 when Elizabeth comes to the throne. So the sense, and they call them, I mean, in the 1540s, they refer to themselves as the former monks of the convent. Now the sense in which their self-identity is still relating to their early experience. On Elizabeth's accession, there are 10 of there, 7, of course, then refuse to go along with the new regime. So you can be pretty confident that you've had a strong, inverted commas, Catholic tradition surviving at Durham for the 20 years after the dissolution. And there. And the last link with the old priory, that former priory, is only broken in 1594 with the death of a canon, George Cliff. So again, you know, that monastic tradition. And in the 1580s, someone in Durham writes an account of the life of Durham Cathedral Priory on the eve of the Reformation, with, not surprisingly also, critical observances about what the Protestants have done since. It's called The Rite of Durham, it's published by the Servan Society, not the Surtee Society. And it's a very, and that's written in 1580s, possibly by George Cliff, certainly by someone who knew the community quite well. And again, he's recording, if you like, the sort of loss that the Reformation had seen. So again, evidence of strong survival of monastic, within the monastic communities, of a continuing, I think, engagement with the traditional religion of the late medieval church. Now, they're not active opponents, many of these, the seven who left in 1558 were, but they're certainly not ones that are going to bring about the Reformation. They were, as I said, scholarly men, many of them. They were embedded, many of them, in their local communities. And that brings me on to the whole question of social power and social and political power and what that tells us about the process of reform. Here, I think, we need to look in the north at aristocratic power. We know in Durham you have the Percys and the Nevilles who dominate the region in terms of them and their tenants. There's only one other key, as it were, source of power, and it's an important one in the region to set against the Nevilles, and that is the bishopric and the chapter. The Bishop of Durham, unlike, of course, any other bishop, it's a county palatine, which is a sort of system which means that actually the Bishop of Durham is also the chief magistrate in the county. He combines in his person political and ecclesiastical authority. And that's unique in England, and there are the prince bishops in Germany who've got some of the electors there in the Holy Roman Empire. There are some there. It's set up a unique form, if you like, in the county of Durham anyway. And I've come back to that because it's quite important. Cuthbert Tunstall, a humanist scholar, is the prince bishop at that time, a strong opponent of reform, notwithstanding his humanist credentials. He led the campaign against Lutheran books in the 1520s when Bishop of London. He gets in so much trouble with Edward VI during the Edwardian Reformation that the bishopric is dissolved for a while because they can't deal with him. He's too powerful as a magistrate. So here you see the institution, social power, dependent upon aristocratic authority of a conservative nature, and the only alternative is the ecclesiastical power, which is also at this stage of a conservative nature, certainly after 1560 and into the end of 1560. In Lancashire, we have the Stanley family, the Earl of Derby. Again, Catholic throughout, to the 1580s, late 1580s.
Loyalist.
They're related, of course, to Elizabeth, they're cousins, they're potential successors. So the Stanley family are very interesting. They are courted by the Catholics, they're courted by the seminary priest, they're courted by William Allen, cardinal set up Darien. They're courted by the Percys and the Nevilles at the time of the Northern Rebellion, but Stanley remains aloof from opposition. He's a Catholic, but he's loyalist, and the state have no other institution in the leadership to set against him. Unlike in Durham, where there's a powerful cathedral and a powerful bishopric, in Lancashire, a new diocese, the Diocese of Chester, created out of the old abbey, poorly endowed, poorly endowed bishopric, poorly endowed chapter. There's no, as it were, no potential source which the Crown can use to build up strong tenancy and sort of landholding connections to set off against the Stanley power. So the Stanleys are effectively running Lancashire a bit like that phrase which those of your teachers will come across in the recent issue, a monarchical republic. Effectively, Lancashire is run by the Stanleys and their tenants. All right, and they're sort of, and then the state negotiates with the Stanleys and does not push, and does not, cannot push its policies too far against them, and chooses not to. One or two attempts. They try to set up a council briefly in Lancashire, and it gets nowhere. They set up an ecclesiastical commission for the Diocese of Chester in 1581, which has some power, but it doesn't provide a sort of a link to central authority which can countermand the local social power of the landowning, or principally the Stanleys, the landowning groups there. So there's no other alternative than to work with these Catholic loyalists there. Okay? Now, Cumberland and Westmorland, you've got the Cliffords as well, another conservative family. So aristocratic conservatism is very powerful as a sort of way of, if you like, sustaining the tradition of belief. Possibly that's too strong, certainly delaying the sort of impact of Reformation changes in these counties. Yorkshire power is much more dispersed. You've got that sort of Catholic landowners up in the Far Dales with the Scroope family, again where there are the great abbeys of Jervaux, fountains up there and Coverdale, so you've got that kind of tradition. But elsewhere, you have a much more dispersed model of social power. In the West Riding, the textile towns are very important, and the landowning families, the gentry families around them. In the East Riding, the Hull and the merchant families of Hull, who then move out through their commercial prosperity, such as Boyntons, by estates outside in the East Riding, create another kind of gentry base which the Crown can work with and explore and develop as servants. So you've got sort of in the East Riding certainly, and in the West, in the textile area, the West Ridings, alternative models, if you like, for state penetration of the locality. York, a major ecclesiastical powerhouse here, with an early reforming archbishop in Robert Holgate, is also, of course, an entry point for state policy into the region. Holgate, for example, introduces the works of Calvin and Erasmus and Luther into the cathedral library in the 1540s and 1550s when he's archbishop. So you've got those opportunities there in Yorkshire, which are less clear in other parts of the north. Opportunities to, as it were, override local social and political power. And that's done through the Council of the North, set up, revived after the Pilgrims of Grace. And are any of you Northerners? Right. Well, you'll always know whenever there's something going on about Yorkshire, if you read the news, that we need another Council of the North to represent the North, they always say. And this is a complete inverse of what was going on. Because actually, what the Council of the North was a council directly answering to the Crown to make sure the Crown policy was adhered to in the North. Most of the presidents were not Northerners, and the most famous ones I talk about weekly, Wotton, in order to, as it were, supervise and countermand local political power, which the state felt it couldn't trust. Too many Catholics, too many people associated with traditional ways of working. Hence, as it were, the Council of North is set up not to represent the North, but to actually manage the North from the centre. And that's what it does. And that's a very powerful institution. And it's one of the ones which, allied to the Archbishopric in the 1570s and 1580s, is very active in, as we come to see, in fostering, if you like, evangelization. So there we have that different patterns of social power and, sort of, as it were, obligation in the area. What about the institutional structures of the church? Because they're important. Right, well, the negative ones, and I think in, it's said about everywhere, I guess, but actually I think it's particularly true in the upland regions of the north. We have large parishes covering large areas which are poorly endowed. Poor clergy. And you have chapelries have to be set up, otherwise people can't even get to the services. And even the curacy even less well endowed, if you like. So what you have, in many ways, is an impoverished institutional structure. It's very hard to get bright young men from the universities to come and work in these places. Why would you when you've got a living available in London or in Hampshire or somewhere? So, that, and there is a brain drain from the north, it has to be said, because there is a tradition of northern grammar schools. Yeah, which grew out of the monastic schools, which is sending people to Oxford and Cambridge, very few of whom go back, come back. Like Wales, as it happens, as well. And that's a parallel one might like to make. So that there's a sense in which the impoverished nature and difficult nature of upland parochial organisation means that evangelisation is difficult. And when Archbishop Grindal comes to York as Archbishop in 1570, having been in London, and previously, of course, having been in exile under Mary, a very committed preacher, he is absolutely appalled by the state of preaching in the diocese. We have no more than three preachers in the whole of the diocese, he says, when he gets there. Not only that, he walks around the churches and he sees wood screens everywhere still. That's great, right? And he sees the mystery plays still going on in 1570 in York, right? Suppresses them, in fact. And he also hears the tolling of bells at funerals. So there's a sense in which here is, if you like, a Protestant exile, former exile, committed sort of Protestant church leader, having been in London, having been on the side of the kind of more Puritan side of the London clergy in the crisis of 1567, finding himself, and probably pushed up here, I think, to get away from that. I mean, North, if he's up here, he can fight with tradition because he knows that's the enemy and he's not going to disturb the sort of state of the equilibrium down south. And so that's what Grindal does, and so that's what he finds. So you've got impoverished institutional church, and that is, if it's true of Yorkshire, it's even more true of Lancashire, and certainly true of Cumberland and Westmorland. Parts of Durham, less so. Northumberland, certainly, but there are some important sort of and wealthy parishes in and around Durham, largely linked to the Dean and Chapter estates as well. So Durham is perhaps a bit of an exception there. But that's what you've got. What strengths do you have? Well, what strengths do we have? Well, you have, I said in Durham, you have that cathedral and the chapter and the Prince Bishop. And I've said how that was a very powerful force for sustaining traditional loyalties up to 1560. But equally, once that generation go, it's a very powerful vehicle for bringing the Reformation to the region by the careful appointment of clergy to the cathedral. And that's precisely what the Crown do. Two returning exiles, James Pilkington as bishop and William Whittingham, the contributor to the Geneva Bible and also a translator of the Psalms, arrive in Durham as bishop and dean, and they very quickly gathered to them a group of other evangelical Protestants. Thomas Lever, another former exile, was one, and then his brother Ralph, and you get the cathedral becoming, if you like, the centre of an active proselytizing Protestantism from mid-1560s. Okay? And that's when ecclesiastical authority in the north starts to challenge the authority of the aristocratic leaders. Okay? And after the debacle of the Northern Rebellion, when briefly, of course, they got into Durham Cathedral and they restored the mass for about a month, but after the collapse of the Northern Rebellion, the traditional power in the north, in Northumberland and Durham, is destroyed, and effectively the Dean and Chapter and the Bishop become the dominant presences politically and socially as well as religiously in those regions, and it becomes effectively the source of the bringing of the Reformation to the northern counties. And it's very important for the Crown strategically, of course. It's on a border, so the people they have there, Pilkington, Whittingham, later on Toby Matthew, about whom I probably could say too much, who's both Dean and Bishop there for a period of 25 years, then comes as Archbishop of York for another 20 years, so a very key figure. They're all committed Protestant preachers, and they bring together around them like-minded scholars and like-minded preachers, and that's when, if you like, you begin to get the process of evangelization. The same is done at York by Archbishop Grindal when he arrives, bringing up bright young men to the Minster in canonries, quite well established, comfortably endowed, placing them then there to move out from the cathedral to act as a preaching ministry throughout the diocese. And I think people think cathedrals, the sort of 18th century vision of cathedrals, is, well, actually, the Protestant bishops had a very clear view of what cathedrals could do. And they were not corporate bodies looking after their profit, but they did that as well. They were the centre of preaching and evangelisation. And so, one of the more famous ones, which Grindal brings, is a man called Edmund Bunny. And he gives him a canonry in the Minster, and it gives him one of the few wealthy rural livings in the parish, Bolton Percy. And from there, Bunny preaches throughout the diocese, right? You know, nice pictures of him talking about walking in his black coat and black hat around. He's a very well-known, and not only does he preach, he's the first translator of Calvin's Institutes into English, and he's an effective polemical writer as well. So he writes devotional works, polemical works, and translates the Institutes. And these are the kind of people who, from the 1570s, who start, I think, the process, the real process, of Reformation. And the cathedrals, I think, should not be ignored, have a central part in that story. Matthew brings a library to Durham, a scholar from Oxford, and that library winds at Durham, then ends up in York, and he moves to York, and it's now the basis of the Minster Library. That library is his library, but it's a public library too, for other clergy. And other clergy get access to his library, and from that library, they produce effective anti-Catholic polemic. Francis Bunny and Edmund Bunny are two writing in the early 17th century effectively against Catholic propaganda, particularly against Parsons, not the Parsons and the Jesuits, and also Thomas Bell, one of the more interesting figures who flits through late Elizabethan England, Catholic one time, not again, then again, but actually eventually falls down on the side of the Protestants and becomes a very effective anti-Catholic propagandist who, of course, had the virtue, and it was the virtue, if that's what it is, of knowing it from the inside as well. So you get a very powerful, effective propaganda campaign organised from the cathedral. I've mentioned the Council of the North, that's the other great, as it were, effective instrument. And again, in trying to cope with a shortage of preaching, Grindal and Huntingdon, who's the president of the Council of the North, as it were, invest money in preaching, establishing preaching in key towns in the diocese of Leeds, Whitby, Halifax. They produce, as it were, funds through, and then they get men up to provide preaching platforms in those key towns. So the Council of North, as it were, the state has to assist the cathedral in Yorkshire, whereas in Durham, I think, because
The bishop was also. Never mind. The chief, no idea what that was. The bishop was also the chief magistrate. The bishop more or less acted by himself. Now, so that's, I think, they're the factors which are influencing the course of the Reformation. How did ideas get transmitted, however? Well, I've talked about the library, I've talked about anti-Catholic propaganda. Really what I'm talking about, when I say anti-Catholic propaganda in the early 17th century, there's a suggestion there, of course, that the church in the north is still in a kind of defensive mode, writing against the enemy as much as producing its own theology. Now, the two go together, of course, but we want to, I think we need to explore that a bit more. What was mission? I mentioned the poverty of the area, the poverty of the living in the area, and therefore the general poor, if poor is the right word, character of the clergy. And I think it's an unfair thing. Of course, the ministry changes. Many of these men were not preachers, but that does not mean they were not good pastors. And I think that's one of the fallacies and one of the shibboleths of Reformation history often, that actually a quiet sort of pastoral ministry gets forgotten in the course of the debates about who's right and who's wrong. So many of these, I think many of the people were very satisfied with what they were getting from their clergy. They were getting the rites of passage, they were probably getting the occasional homily, they were certainly getting kindness and probably a bit of charity, mostly. We don't know, but there were not too many complaints as they weren't. So there's a sense in which one sort of has to work from silence. But what they weren't getting, of course, was preaching of vigorous Protestant evangelisation. And an argument could be made that in certain parts of North England, the earliest post-Reformation evangelisation in some of the rural parts is actually Catholic, not Protestant. That is to say, once the Douay and the missionary priests start coming from 1577, and they pick off this region, Lancashire provides both the largest number of priests to Douay, because of the family connections, and then through Whitby, many of them come back in. So there's a strong presence of Catholic missionaries in this part of the country, where they can, if you like, embed themselves in the communities which they're connected to. And in a sense, one could argue in those regions that it's these missionaries that bring post-Reformation religion, in this case Tridentine religion, this is why it can be identified, to the region where beforehand they have yet to have Protestant evangelisation. This is recognised, I think, certainly by Toby Matthew, who sets up his library to address this and to counter these people, and also sets up his attempt to provide an alternative way of providing pastoral initiatives. And with one of the great works of Catholic pastoral religion is Parsons' Christian Directory. And what Matthew does is he gets Edmund Bunny to produce a Protestant version of it. He recognises the force, if you like, of that pastoral work for helping people understand the way through life. And Bunny more or less plagiarises it and takes out the most obvious Catholic bits of it. So you've got, as it were, a pastoral battle going on in North England over for the souls, if you like, of the parishioners. And it's originally based on the Catholic Christian Directory. So there's an argument to be said, I suppose, that the most effective pastoral work in post-Reformation Northern England before 1660 was actually a Catholic one, because it was either Parsons' one itself or it was Bunny's version of it that became a sort of standard pastoral work. So that's a pastoral guide. So you've got those contests going on. You've got therefore you have to revive missionary. Then you get preaching, and by the early 17th century, we can say, I think, that in Durham, County Durham, in most parts of Yorkshire, in south east Lancashire, there is a largely graduate preaching clergy, right, present of clearly graduate preaching Protestant clergy. There are pockets where that doesn't take place. East Riding also, a strong one there. There are pockets where that doesn't take place. We know 1604, Toby Matthew could say there are only four preachers in the whole of Northumberland. But we still know that there are those difficult areas. We know about Westmorland and Cartmel, a story of Robert Shaw, a preacher, one of my preachers, who's sent there and is horrified by the superstition, as he sees it, of the local farmers and farming community, who are still sort of saying prayers over their animals and all sorts. Now, there's a sense of which I think Robert Shaw is a sort of well-educated Protestant intellectual is misled by what I call some farmer's stories. Don't listen to the locals, you know, because once they know that you buy these stories, I think they kind of egg them on a bit, and the account is kind of funny if you read it that way. But it's nevertheless the case that there's a large sort of in the upland rural areas, there's still a strong, strong as it were, attachment to traditional religious forms as late as the 1630s. Now what I'm trying to say here, I think, is that the Reformation, I think, in the north of England, if we're talking about evangelisation, doesn't really kick off until the late 1560s and 1570s. Whereas, I think, in the south of England, we can say by the mid-1580s, Jackie may correct me, we can be confident in the Midlands, Shire, and south east of England that we've got, broadly speaking, strong coverage of Protestant preaching clergy throughout most of the counties. In the north of England, in the north of England, we cannot say that until the 1610s or the 1620s in some cases. Right? But actually, the Reformation is taking place a generation later up here than it's taking place elsewhere. And that's partly, that principally, I mean, partly due to the institutional weakness of the Northern Church, partly due to the difficulties of actually Christianisation in that terrain anyway. We're not quite sure, as it were, what went on before. But what it does explain, though, too, is that that's not a lively religious, a strong attachment to traditional forms, but quite quickly, in the face of evangelization, once it starts in the 18th century, that religion falls away. So there's a tenacious hold and then a rather quick collapse within a generation. And I think that's a question about, therefore, when we talk about tenacious hold, we have to say how deep that was. What actually, you know, was it just a kind of socio-religious attachment, or was it a sort of evangelical fervour? And the answer, I think, the evidence suggests it was the former, I think, and that the old religion was a way of life rather than a set of beliefs, if you like. And when that alternative set of beliefs was provided, which helped to make sense of an alternative way of life, that old religion quickly fell away. So the view from the north, I think, is a generation later, generally speaking, than the story we pick up from a study of the South. I talked for 40 minutes, I think, 45 minutes. So probably said enough, and left open, I hope, a few questions for you. So we leave it there, I think that's right.
Thank you very much.